Okay, so welcome everybody to the sutta class today, the Sabbasava Sutta, Majjhima number 2, and according to Venerable Anālaya, this has 3 Chinese parallel suttas, one of them, as we might expect, in the Majjhima Agama, one in the Ekottara Agama, which is the Chinese equivalent of the, or corresponding collection to the Anguttara Nikaya, and one independent sutta, T31, which was translated very early by Anshu Gao, between 148 and 170 AD. Anshu Gao was one of the earliest of all the translators into Chinese, and translated quite a lot of interesting sutta material. He didn't translate any whole agamas, but quite a lot of bits and pieces, partial collections and individual suttas, and so on. This one, T31, should be a translation of, should be part of a collection of suttas considered to be part of the Digha, or the Digha collection, if I'm not wrong. So that means it was like an individual sutta, which was kind of floating around in the tradition, picked up somehow, but regarded anyway by the Taisho editors, the editors of the Chinese canon, as somehow belonging to the Digha. I'm not exactly sure why that is so. So then one version belonged to Majjhima, one version belonging to the Ekottara. And it's worth noticing that the Ekottara in Chinese, which we've done some readings from last year, has quite a lot of suttas which we might expect to find in the Majjhima Nikaya, and indeed many of those we might expect to find in the Sangyutta Nikaya. And so it actually collects quite a lot of very central and important suttas. And now this one, Sabbasava Sutta, all the whats, all the asavas. Now, how do we translate asava? Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as taints. What's a taint?
It's opposite of a tis.
A taint is the opposite of a tis. Taint and tis. That's very good. That's extremely good. I like it, yeah. But I suspect it's perhaps not the kind of taint which is meant here. It's just a suspicion. Taint and tis. Of course, taint being translated many ways. Bhikkhu Bodhi gives a brief mention in the introduction to the Majjhima Nikaya. The asavas, or taints, are a classification of defilements considered in their role of sustaining the samsaric round. The commentaries derive the word from the root su, meaning to flow. Scholars differ as to whether the flow implied by the prefix a is inward or outward. So we have these two words, sava, from the root su, meaning to flow, and a, meaning either inwards or outwards. So for example, you have anapana, right? In-breath and out-breath. So a, so anapana, ana being in-breath and pana being out-breath. So the different prefix, ana or pana, denotes either coming in or going out in that case. But even there, the reciters of the Digha Nikaya say that it's the other way around. It's actually out-breaths and in-breaths, which I just don't think is very plausible, because you usually have to breathe in first before you're going to breathe out. Otherwise, it doesn't really work the other way around. And so there seems to be a bit of scholarly jostling around this particular point. Hence, some have rendered it as influxes or influences, others as outflows or effluents, influences being A.K. Water's preference, effluent being Venerable Tanisaro's for a period of time. He preferred effluent, and then he later preferred fermentations. A stock passage in the suttas indicates the term's real significance independently of etymology when it describes the asavas as states that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. Thus, other translators, bypassing the literal meaning, have rendered it cankers. Does anybody know what a canker is?
Various things. It's another word for cancer.
It's another word for cancer. Sister Jutiman knows what it is because she studied Buddhism before, right?
Well, I just know what the English means.
But would you know what the English meant if you hadn't read Buddhist things?
You have cankers on trees.
So you have cankers on trees, okay. So we have two specialists, James. Your medical knowledge, if you could translate that for us?
canker.
Yeah, canker.
And also be it's an older word.
Yeah.
I have seen it used in described it as generally by laity type people to describe something that's attached to something.
Mm.
For example, say in a dog, you can have canker of the ear, which is not a cancer at all. But it may be, say, in that particular instance, some sort of infective process that produces a swelling, which tends to, by the sound of it, sound like these lumps on trees. They're sort of lumps.
Lumps, okay. Lumps of stuff that maybe ooze?
Yes, sort of lumps.
Very often.
Oozing lumps of...
pustula.
Pustula stuff. So it certainly sounds like the kind of thing that you don't really want.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what a canker is. This was an earlier rendering preferred. Corruptions was it was venerable for a little while. Maurice Walsh's rendering, Corruptions, which is quite nice, or Taints, the latter being the choice of Venerable Nyana Moli. Personally, I don't really like the use of the word taints. For me, a taint is not nearly strong enough. Like a taint is what you put, like when they have, you know, it's like a tint. You put a tint into a paint or something like that. It's like a taint. It's just so that it puts a bit of colour in it. Whereas asavas are much more fundamental than that and not really just like a little bit of tint. Taint is more like a word like upakilesa, where you have like kind of the mind which is very pure, and then you have these very subtle kinds of defilements which just kind of obscure the brightness of the mind. That's more like a taint. This is something that sort of obscures, whereas an asava seems to me has a much more fundamental significance.
Isn't mentioned by Bandashanti as
oozings? Right, oozings, yeah, that's not bad. On the restraint of all the oozings. Okay. So notice that Bhikkhu Bodhi's method there, just a quick little note on asavas, and he mentions the etymology, he mentions the kind of the doctrinal usage in Pali, according to the doctrinal usage, and he also mentions various choices by various translators to try to understand it. Now I would suggest that perhaps none of those methods are really adequate to get at the meaning of the word. And I think we need to go a little bit deeper before we can even start to read the title. So here we go, we're still trying to read the title of the sutta here, guys. And we haven't yet decided what that means, right? So this could take some time. Right, a plus shru, shravati in Sanskrit. So this is a very old word. Now I wonder if it has corresponding words in English or in European languages. I can't think of any off the top of my head. It doesn't list any here. But anyway, very old word in Indic roots. Okay, so here are the meanings that it gives here. This is the Monier Williams Sanskrit dictionary. Okay, now I read in The Guardian today that actually about half of people buy books in order to have more prestige on their bookshelves, okay? And they don't actually read them, but they just put them there so that they look impressive. So if you're in the market for getting any books that are going to look impressive on your bookshelf without actually having to be read, it's a great one. This is really good, yeah. Classic. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole Pali Canon is pretty good, but Moni Williams Sanskrit English Dictionary, it's great. It's a great talking point for those afternoon coffee table discussions and so on. So Moni Williams, one of the great Indologists of the 19th century, who put together this dictionary more than 100 years ago, which still hasn't been superseded. Okay, so asravati, asrava, to flow near or towards. So that's one meaning. To flow, stream or flow from. To spring a leak. To flow off, go off, or deteriorate. To cause to flow, so the causative form, to cause to flow, to bleed, to impel. Okay, so then that's the verbal forms of it. Now then the noun form, asrava, the foam on boiling rice. It's quite interesting, isn't it? A door opening into water and allowing the stream to descend into it. And the Jaina usage that he notes here, the action of the senses which impels the soul towards external objects. One of the seven sattvas or substances, it is twofold as good or evil. So I'll come back to the Jaina usage in a little while, but notice here the meaning of the action of the senses, which impels the soul, the jiva, towards external objects, one of the seven sattvas, sattva being like a really existing substance. And also has the meaning of distress, affliction, or pain. Okay, so then another meaning, it has a few different grammatical forms here with different meanings. Another meaning, a flow, issue, running, discharge, separation, pain, affliction, a particular disease of the body, the objects of sense, a medicine. So it can mean both a disease and a medicine. Oh, no, sorry, asrava bhesaja. Okay, so a medicine for the asravas. Okay. And then asravin, like as a personal form, as a person or a thing which is flowing, emitting fluid, discharging humor, as an elephant who emits fluid from his temples during the rutting time. Okay, festering. So these are some of the meanings which it might have in Sanskrit. So you can see it's obviously got quite a few different applications in different kinds of contexts. Most of them seem to be more the kind of flowing out meaning rather than the flowing in meaning. Let's have a look. I haven't had a chance to really look at this in detail, but I just noted a few contexts where it appears in some of the Jaina texts. And so these are some of the earlier Jaina sutras. This one's translated by Jacobi in the Sacred Books of the East series. So this translated in the 19th century. And again, part of the amazing work that these guys did, originally published in 1895, that these guys did all this work in those days with such little support and resources, and still hasn't been actually done any better. No one's actually retranslated them and improved them. So anyway, here's a bit of a story. I might as well just read out a little bit of a story. This doesn't have much to do with asravas really, but here we go. In the town of Kampila, there was a king named Sanjaya who possessed numerous troops and war chariots, and once he went hunting. He was surrounded on all sides by a large host of horses, elephants, chariots and footmen. He chased the deer on horseback in the Kesara park of Kampila, and intent upon his sport, he killed there the frightened deer. Now in that park there was a homeless ascetic intent on sacred study and meditating upon the Dhamma, annihilating what it translates here as sinful inclinations, i.e. asravas. He meditated in the aspota bower, so in a grove of aspota trees or bushes. So annihilating the asravas. But the king killed the deer that fled to him. When he saw that, the king in his consternation said, "I've nearly hurt this monk, ill-fated and cruel me that is mad for the sport." Having dismissed his horse, the king bowed respectfully to the monk's feet, saying, "Forgive me this, reverend sir." But the venerable monk, being plunged in silent meditation, made no reply to the king, who was therefore seized with fear, and said, "I am Sanjaya. Answer me, Bhante. A monk might by the fire of his wrath reduce millions of men to ashes." So here's the king, worried that he's upset this poor monk who's going to reduce his whole kingdom to ashes. The monk then says, "Be without fear, O king, but grant safety to others also. In this transient world of living beings, why are you so addicted to cruelty? As you must of necessity one day part with everything in this transient world of living beings, why do you cling to kingly power? Transient like a stroke of lightning are life and beauty which you love so much. You do not comprehend what will benefit you in the next life. Wives and children, friends and relations, all are dependent on a man during his life, but they will not follow him in death. The sons in great sorrow will remove the corpse of their father to the cemetery, and so will parents do with their sons and relations. O king, do penance. O king, other men glad and pleased and well attired will enjoy the riches that you have amassed and will dally with your wives that you have so well guarded. And whatever action you have done, whether good or evil, with that karma you will depart to your next existence." After that, Sanjaya gave up his kingly power and adopted the faith of the Jinas in the presence of the venerable monk Gardahabali. So there you go, there's some quite nice teachings there. Very similar to Buddhist teachings. So anyway, we had the idea, simply on the subject of asavas, shows us that the monk was supposed to be Hinasava, has destroyed all the asavas. And then another one here. Also, it's like a description of the the asavas, it gives us a little bit more knowledge in it. It's just a description of the perfect monk or something like that, without property, without egoism, without attachment, without conceit, impartial to all beings, whether they move or not. Indifferent to success or failure, to happiness or misery, to life and death, to blame and praise, to honor and insult, he turned away from conceit and passions, from injurious, hurtful and dangerous actions, from gaiety and sadness. He was free from sins and fetters. He had no interest in this world and no interest in the next world. He was indifferent to unpleasant and pleasant things, to eating and fasting. He prevented the influx of karma, of asrava, through all bad channels or through all the doors. By meditating upon himself, he obtained praiseworthy self-purification and sacred knowledge. Thus he thoroughly purified himself by knowledge, right conduct, faith, penance, that's tapas, and pure meditations. And having lived for many years as a shramana, he reached perfection after breaking his fast once only every month. Only eating once a month. Right. So notice here the idea of asrava, giving us a little bit more of an idea about what it means. It's this idea of like asrava is something which is flowing in through the doors of the senses. Okay, I'll talk more about a little bit more about that in a minute. I'll just go on to another context. Here, asrava, I think, I haven't actually managed to check this, is translated as cardinal passions, and so I presume this is what it's referred to here. Two kinds of mohaniya, though, of the things that cause delusion, referring to conduct, are, one, what is experienced in the form of the four cardinal passions, i.e. the four asravas, and what is experienced in the form of feelings different from them. The first kind of this karma is 16-fold, the second, 7-fold or 9-fold. So we have 16 kinds of karma, which is called asrava, which is the four cardinal passions, 4 times 4, four kinds of asrava, each one divided into 4, and then it lists them. Ayushka is 4-fold, as referring to denizens of hell, animals, men and gods. So asrava is relating to those different realms of existence. Naman is 2-fold, good and bad. Oh, sorry, no, I thought they were 4 times 4. It's not 4 times 4. It's different numbers. Okay. Naman is 2-fold, good and bad. There are many, this is name, of course, there are many subdivisions of the good variety and so of the bad also. So elsewhere it's described and it's like similar to the kinds of species and so on. Gotra is 2-fold, high and low. The first is 8-fold and so is the second also. So gota being the family that one's born into. Antaraya is 5-fold, as preventing gifts, antaraya meaning obstacle, preventing gifts, profit, momentary enjoyment, continuous enjoyment and power. So these are different kinds of karmic obstructions which are also identified with the asravas. So this is giving you like another little hint of what this word, some of the context that the word's used in. And just read one or two more contexts very quickly. This one here says, this is from the Atharanga Sutta, so I should have mentioned before, that previous readings were from the Uttaradhyayana, and then all of them from the Uttaradhyayana, which is one of the older of the Jaina scriptures. All of the Jaina scriptures the Jaina religion was supposed to be contemporary with the Buddha, but all of the scriptures were put together much later, about 400 AD, and the Jains themselves acknowledge that they have lost their early sutras. And so the texts themselves have been put together quite late, but nevertheless they have some early elements in them. This one's quite interesting, Acharanga Sutra. Fourth lecture and first lesson. The Arahants and Bhagavas of the past, present and future all say thus, speak thus, declare thus and explain thus. All breathing, existing, living, sentient beings. So notice they have the same tendency as you find in the Pali to pile on synonyms one after the other as a matter of emphasis. All breathing, existing, living, sentient beings should not be slain, nor treated with violence, nor abused, nor tormented, nor driven away. This is the pure, unchangeable, eternal law which the wise ones who understand the world have declared. So this is quite interesting, being of course very similar to the Buddha's teaching. I won't read all of that, but then it goes on to the second lesson. There are as many asravas as there are parisravas, And there are as many parisravas as there are asravas. And there are as many anasravas as there are aparisravas. And as many aparisravas as there are anasravas. He who well understands these words and regards the world according to the instruction and understands that which has been distinctly declared, that wise man proclaims the truth here to men who still belong in the samsara, who are awakened and have reached discrimination. So, of course, this being entirely incomprehensible, but there are as many asravas as there are parisravas, and the explanation that it gives in the footnote here, asrava is that by means of which karma, takes effect upon the soul. Okay? Parisrava is that by which the influence of karma is counteracted. Okay? And asrava is that by which asrava is avoided. And aparisrava is that by which karma is acquired. Okay, so if we understand it in that way as the kind of the asravas or the defilements and their antidotes, then the idea here is that there is as many different kinds of asravas, okay, then as many different kinds of antidotes, okay, so or of things you do to counteract them. So you have many different kinds of things flowing in, disturbing you, and as many different kinds of methods of stopping them, which, as we'll see, is quite similar to the Buddhist idea. Yeah, of course.
Yes, last week we talked about how ignorance distorts your perception,
mm-hmm.
and so that the asavas start from that misperception through the senses.
Yep.
And this is talking about flowing in as though it was something external flowing in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's like a whole different way of talking.
It's a whole different way of talking, yeah.
A whole different way of talking.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's a good point. I'll come back to that point in a minute. Okay. The next one, next passage is our last passage. I'll read from the Jaina scriptures, but here it gives a little bit of a description, and this is a practice which some of you may be considering, which is how to fast to death in order to reach purity. So, in a village or in a forest, examining the ground and recognizing it as free from living beings, the sage should spread the straw. Without food, he should lie down and bear the pains which attack him. He should not for too long time give way to worldly feelings which overcome him. When crawling animals, or such as live on high or below, feed on his flesh and blood, he should neither kill them nor rub the wound. Reminds me of the great Christian ascetic who used to live up on a pole until he had all these kind of wounds. I can't remember what his name was now. And he had all these kind of sores and things like that. And the flies would come and lay their maggots in the sores, and they'd breed kind of maggots. And then when the maggots fell off, out of compassion, he'd bend down, pick them up and put them back again so that they had something to eat. Though these animals destroy the body, he should not stir from his position. After the asravas have ceased, he should bear pains as if he rejoiced in them. When the bonds fall off, then he has accomplished his life. Okay. And it goes on for some time talking about similar ways of, yes, ritual suicide. Not something which is regarded as being part of the middle way. So I've asked about, now, I haven't been able to find any really kind of decisive context from my little survey of the Jain sutras here, but what I understand from reading the Jain texts is that they have this conception, of like a soul, they call a soul, which they call a jiva meaning life. So the jiva is your soul, and this is a quasi-physical conception, okay? So it's not really physical, nor is it really completely spiritual, but it's quasi-physical. It's as if this jiva is like a pure crystal or something like that. And you can imagine it as if it was like a pure crystal. And then when the mind is open towards the senses, then karma or asava, these two words in Jaina theory are much closer than they are in Buddhism. Okay, karma and asava. In Buddhism, they're quite clearly distinct, but in Jaina, they're closer. And this is why there's that difference between the idea of intention when you're acting, because you can have defilements. In Buddhism, you can have defilements, but you might not choose to act on those defilements. Okay, so I might feel greed for something, but I might not necessarily choose to act on that greed, and so therefore I'm not making karma according to Buddhism, right? But in Jainism, those things are very much closer, and so you've got like this pure crystal, like this crystal monad, and then when the doors of the senses are opened, then the asrava can flow in. And so it's like a pollutant which flows in through those doors, which are not guarded properly, and which will cloud and pollute the inherent brightness of the jiva, of the soul. And so the purpose of practice, and they very strongly emphasize the practice of restraint is one of them that they emphasize very strongly, to close off those doors and to... It was like this idea of tapas, because always mentioned talking about tapas being the burning fire of asceticism, okay? And it's almost like that burning fire, it's almost purifying, like purifying a metal or something like that, where you burn it and burn off the impurities. And so it's almost as if the impurities, asavas, are actually burnt out of this jiva, which is purified. And then at the end of that process, they have this, you know, quite beautiful image, like when the body is laid down, especially if you fast to death, like it describes there, then the jiva is liberated, and like all the jivas you become completely omniscient. So the liberated jiva literally knows everything which is happening in the world, and will then like float upwards through the cosmos, and then so all the jivas are like kind of floating like stars in the ceiling of the cosmos. This is their idea of liberation. And so Jainism is like a generation before the Buddha. So last week I talked about Upanishads and about how this is like a generation or a couple of generations philosophically before the Buddha, and one of the contexts which the Buddha was answering to. And in the same way, the Jaina religion was one of the contexts which the Buddha was answering to, which he was sometimes adopting the terminology of, but adapting it to his own point of view. And Jainism has much more of that slightly materialistic implication than Buddhism does. And so, you know, this being, of course, one of the characteristics of Buddhism is always pointing to the mind, yeah, always pointing to your intention, to your awareness, being the key points of Buddhism, and the Jaina system being a bit more mechanistic. There's not so much about, like, say, meditation, introspection into your mind, all of these kinds of things are not so much an important part of the Jaina system. So I think, given the importance of the asravas in the Jaina system, and given that they were around before the Buddha, I think it's likely that the Buddha adopted the terminology on the asravas from the Jains, and that he, of course, not adopting it in exactly the same way, but having that similar kind of idea. And so this explains, I think, Arina, that point that you were just making about that different kind of idea about the asravas, that the from the Jaina perspective, it's not so much about your perceptual distortions, but more about something which is actually flowing in from inside. And that's like a connotation of the term which it derives from that kind of Jaina context, yeah, but which is not necessarily relevant in the Buddhist context. So, just as another... little point of reflection on this to show how it has been adopted into Buddhism. We notice that in the Jaina tradition that there's the idea that there are different kinds of asavas, and that they had different kinds of appropriate methods to counteract them. Now, on this little sheet which Sister Jutima has copied for us, made by Bhikkhu Bodhi, it has a comparison of the different kinds of defilements, the ways that the different defilements are characterized or classified in different systems. And this being quite important. Now, the process of doing this is precisely what we call Abhidhamma. Okay? So here what you can see, that what Bhikkhu Bodhi is doing is almost definitively what actually Abhidhamma means. Abhi means above, or like abstracted from. And so here we have these various kinds of dhammas, and we now take it another level to compare one Dhamma to the next. And this is one of the great projects of the Abhidhamma school. So I don't mean this is Abhidhamma in the sense of being part of the Abhidhamma Pitaka. I'm not sure whether it is or not, probably not. It's probably a thing which Bhikkhu Bodhi has done for himself. But the kind of thing that he's doing is the kind of thing which we find very characteristic of the Abhidhamma. And so what he's done is he's shown that there are correspondences between these different kinds of classifications of defilements, and that even though they're expressed in various ways, that broadly speaking, they describe the same kind of thing. So the most detailed list on the left is the 10 sanyojanas: identity view, sakkaya ditthi, doubt, vichikicca, wrong grasp of rules and observances, silabhata paramasa, sensual desire, ill will, desire for form, desire for formless, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. So these being the 10 sanyojanas. Now these being broadly similar to the 7 kinds of anusaya. Anusaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as latent tendencies. Anu meaning along, saya meaning to lie, lying or underlying. So here he equates views with the sanyojana number 1 and 3, identity view and wrong grasp of rules and observances. Doubt is equivalent to doubt, lust and aversion to sensual desire and ill will. Desire for existence, bhavaraga, he's equated with desire for form and desire for formless, conceit and ignorance. So this most interesting part of this equation, something I've noticed before, is that this, if we do make this list, it becomes fairly obvious that the anusaya of desire for existence, bhavaraga, is equivalent to ruparaga, aruparaga, i.e. The attachment to being reborn as a result of practicing form or formless jhanas. So this is one of the important meanings of bhava in Buddhism, is the desire for rebirth, according to, especially the desire for rebirth in the rupa loka or arupa loka. And the asavas usually being 3 in number, asava of views, sensuality, desire for existence, bhavasava, being equivalent again to rupa raga, arupa raga, and then finally the asava of ignorance, which is found in some lists, and as Bhikkhu Bodhi notes, it's usually understood that the list of 3 asavas is earlier, and that the 4th asava of ignorance is added at a later date. It's found in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, possibly added as a result or as a part of this kind of systematizing tendency that we find in the Abhidhamma, that under the influence of these other lists, that the ignorance asava of ignorance was added. So all this list shows us is that these things are really talking about the same thing in different ways. And really the difference between them is not so much the difference in the content, but the difference in the metaphor. Now, I was talking about this last week, about how important that this is, that the idea of the metaphor as giving us an idea or an angle on the particular kind of defilement. Now that we consider the defilement as a fetter, right? It's something that binds us. This is one kind of metaphor. Do we think it's something that's underlying, yeah? It's like, it's almost like a, something hidden or something which is intrinsic. Or do we consider it as like an asava, almost like as a disease or as a fermentation or whatever these other kinds of things. So these are all metaphors for understanding, these different kinds of defilements. So this is a bit of background just on the idea of asavas in general. At the end of that, you know, how do we translate asavas? My personal suggestion and usage for a little while has been simply to translate asavas as defilements. Normally we translate kilesa as defilement, but as it happens, kilesa is not really found very often in the Pali canon, in the suttas. And it's more of a later terminology, so it doesn't cause too much of a conflict. And defilement being more, I think, more readily accessible as an English term than some of these other ones like cankers and so on and so forth. Anyway, that's just my suggestion. So, any questions so far?
So you're saying that you like the word defilement rather than taint?
Yeah. Now, so we've managed to read the title so far. That's good. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus. Bhante, they replied, the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on the restraint of all the taints. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Bhante, the bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. Now notice that this introduction is similar or virtually identical to the introduction of the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. And it says, I will teach you a discourse on the root of all things. And now here it says, I will teach you a discourse on the restraint of all the taints. And notice that Sutta number 3 then doesn't have this kind of introduction anymore. Here in Sutta number 3 he just says, bhikkhus. And they reply, Venerable Sir. And I think that usage is maintained for most of the following suttas. So perhaps the compilers of the Majjhima Nikaya use this more extended or slightly more formal introduction, and they're actually giving it a title, Sabbasava Dhamma Pariyaya, Sabbasava Sangvara Pariyaya, sorry, is the title of the sutta, Sabbasava Sangvara Pariyaya. And they perhaps intended that this kind of formal beginning be used for the beginning of all the suttas, but they didn't actually spell it out in all cases. Anyway, it is quite noteworthy that this is found on the first two discourses here. Okay. Because I say that the destruction, or perhaps the exhaustion, the ending, the evaporation of the taints, is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. So I've mentioned this word before, this kaya, not really meaning destruction, okay? It's translated as destruction, but doesn't really mean destruction, because destruction means you've got something and then you bash it over the head with a big club. This is what destruction means, whereas kaya never means bashing something over the head with a big club. There are other words in Pali which you use to describe that, such as nasati or something like that. And kaya and its various forms always mean something to the ending of something, the evaporation of something, the evaporation of a stream, the using up of supplies, the waning of the moon. Yeah, these are the kinds of context where kaya is used. So it's much more gentle than destruction. Destruction is quite, I mean, the Buddha was pretty strong sometimes, but the particular word kaya is much more gentle with It's difficult to find an exact translation. Perhaps the best one is exhaustion, in the sense of exhausting one's supplies, but unfortunately we usually think of exhaustion meaning getting very tired, which is not really the meaning. And it's also the using up, or the bringing to an end, the evaporation of defilements. I say that anyway, we'll continue with Bhikkhu Bodhi's renderings for now, just to make it simple. For one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. So this is, again, this is, it might sound fairly obvious to us, but this is kind of taking a stand among the religions and philosophies and so on of the time, that Buddhism is a Gnostic religion, i.e. it's one which emphasizes the power of knowing, the power of spiritual realization, rather than, for example, wearing something out because of your karma, wearing something, just enduring it. And so the Jaina perspective would be you simply have to endure things and burn them up through the power of your austerities. It's not about actually knowing and seeing things, it's about just enduring them and burning them up. Whereas Buddhism is about actually understanding them. This is one of those stock phrases which we find in many different contexts. So who knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. So yoniso manasikara and ayoniso manasikara. Wise attention, yoniso meaning literally according to the cause or the source, and unwise not according to the source. So these kinds of, these phrases usually mean, talking about something like an investigation into causality. When one attends into the root of things, where do things come from? When one attends unwisely, unarisen taints arise and arisen taints increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise and arisen taints are abandoned. Okay? Because there are taints that should be abandoned by seeing, there are taints that should be abandoned by restraining, there are taints that should be abandoned by using, there are taints that should be abandoned by enduring, there are taints that should be abandoned by avoiding, there are taints that should be abandoned by removing, there are taints that should be abandoned by developing. So here we have a list of 7 different kinds. Of seven different kinds of means of getting rid of the taints, and we'll have a look at each of those in turn. Now, I mentioned earlier that there are these different versions of this, all of the Chinese versions are similar in listing seven different methods, and the introduction is also very similar, and the way that the methods are described is also quite similar. The only different version really is there's another version called the Asava Sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya, and in the Asava Sutta is very similar, except it only has six out of seven methods, and the first method, the method of seeing, is not found. Okay, so this sutta being of course found in the sixes of the Anguttara Nikaya. So then the Buddha goes on to talk about the different fetters to be abandoned by different kinds of methods. So what taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by seeing? Now it's interesting that the Buddha talks about here that certain fetters to be abandoned by seeing and certain fetters to be abandoned by various other kinds of things. But he started out the whole discourse by saying that the abandonment of the taints is for one who knows and sees. So, hasn't he just contradicted himself? Hasn't he just said that abandoning taints is because of seeing? And then he says, well, some of them to be abandoned by seeing and others to be abandoned by other ways. Haven't we just caught the Buddha out in contradicting himself?
Not until we realize what he means by seeing, maybe.
He says it's by knowing and seeing that we get rid of taints, and then he says, oh, no, it's knowing and seeing and all these other things that we get rid of taints. Is there a contradiction there?
I don't see that that could be read into this at all.
You don't think it means the same? Why not?
One is generalized. And this is the practical application.
Practical application. But do these other methods replace knowing and seeing?
Issues from knowing and seeing.
Issues from knowing and seeing. So perhaps one's to understand that doing these other practices also with while knowing and seeing, yeah, not just simply blindly doing them because one's told, but also knowing and seeing while actually doing the other practices. Yeah. Perhaps something like that might be intended.
That's Silabhata.
Right, if you're not doing it while knowing and seeing, then that would be silabhata, yeah? That would be silabhata paramasa, yeah?
Attachment
to, how Bhikkhu is translated as wrong grasp of rules and observances. And I think that's very true, and that's, again, would be maybe a difference between the Buddhist approach and the Jaina approach, that there's more emphasis on actually understanding what you're doing rather than simply doing it for the sake of it. Okay. Because what taints that should be abandoned by seeing? Here, because an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma and does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he attends to those things unfit for attention and does not attend to those things fit for attention. So notice here the number of connections. So you see how the suttas always kind of interweave themselves. So this one, we've already interweaved this section, we remember from the Mula Pariyaya Sutta last week, which also talks about the Patujana who is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dhamma of the noble ones and so on. So we've got this repeating phrase. So we're already tying it up to the first sutta, okay? But we're also tying it back into the opening passage of the thing where it talks about the different kinds of attention, manasikara. So this is how the suttas work. They work by kind of continually weaving and interweaving and weaving out and weaving back in. And so there's this very rich, what they call intertextuality, where one sutta, one passage or one sutta is constantly like existing in dependence and in relationship to countless other passages. And so this is why we often find that if we read one passage by itself, that it seems to be have a certain poverty of meaning, because we're only seeing like one aspect of it. But it's only when we've followed through all those different links and those different aspects in different contexts that the richness of the meaning emerges. It doesn't emerge just from one context.
And is that why it's called suttas then? Because suttas is read.
Yeah, it's weaved. Yeah, weaving. What are the things unfit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire arises in him and the arisen taint of sensual desire increases. The unarisen taint of being arises in him and the arisen taint of being increases. The unarisen taint of ignorance arises in him and the arisen taint of ignorance increases. These are the things unfit for attention that he attends to. So here, anyway, he's defining it not in terms of specifics, but a general principle. Whatever you attend to, whatever you direct your mind towards, that will give rise to more sensual desire and more the taint of being and the taint of ignorance. So these three things being, as I mentioned, the usual list of taints: sensual desire, bhava, being or existence, and ignorance. And so interesting here that we can understand how sensual desire is like a defilement. Yeah, we can understand how ignorance is a defilement, but what about being or existence? Is being itself a defilement? Yeah, this is interesting. Buddha, this is, we had a kind of nice long argument with Richard Dixie in Bodh Gaya about this particular point. Is existence inherently negative, so that your very existence is a kind of a negative thing, or is existence neutral? So here the word bhava, or Bhikkhu Bodhi, is translated as being in deference to Venerable Nyanamoli, who originally rendered it as being in his thing. But I think that it's much better rendered as existence in for many different reasons. And so we would translate the arisen, the defilement of existence. Right? So I mentioned before that one of the meanings, like we can take that in a very general sense, but it also has a more specific doctrinal sense, as we've seen by correlating it with the Samyojanas and the Anusayas, where bhava raga, but karmasava, sensual desire, covers that attachment which would cause you to be reborn in the karma loka, right? Which means in the human realm, the heavenly realms, and so on. The bhavasava would be those defilements which not, you've got rid of sensual desire, but you've still got an attachment to being reborn, to being bhava, to existence, and then that will cause you to be reborn in the Brahma realms if you practice jhanas. Okay? So this is that bhavasava, and the avijasava is the most subtle of all, that subtle unknowing. So that's like a more specific doctrinal sense of that, but it can also be understood in a more general sense, that just the attachment to existence itself, to life itself, is a defilement.
Also, so we could all lie down.
Well, like the Jainas, and just lie down and
start with it and get the magazine.
Yeah. And that's what it says in a passage there. I didn't quite find an individual one, but it actually says one should neither long for life nor long for death. Yeah, in that Jaina thing.
Awesome. I know what you just said about that, because the anagami gets rid of the central desire, and but still has the craving for existence,
mm-hmm.
and then also has ignorance. So
yep.
Anagami between us, so it'd be interesting to know that too.
Yep. Yeah. They got rid of little bit by little bit, and not rid of all at once. Huh? Even the anagami has this defilement of existence. I find it interesting when I'm reading these suttas, like if I'm reading, especially if I'm reading to lay people, and you sort of come to this bit and you said, we've got rid of all the defilements of sensuality, defilements of existence, and defilements of ignorance. It's like, what? Defilements of existence, but there you go.
Yeah, if you take it on a dependent origination thing, then existence is defined as different classes of beings, right?
Mm-hmm. So oh, no, that's birth is a different class of beings.
What's,
yeah.
What's existence defined as?
Existence is defined as...
It's free existence, right? The free...
Conditions
for birth, I think. Existence is... the necessary condition for
that,
but I can't remember what existence
is
defined as.
It's just defined as, it just mentions in the dependent, in the actual definition of dependent origination, it just mentions the karma bhava, rupa bhava, arupa bhava. Yeah.
I also take not only for existence, but that sense of creating an identity by embellishing whatever experience they're having.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this belief is the right belief, it's my belief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that sense of building,
mm-hmm.
Identity building existence, as part of wrong view and ignorance, rather than seeing it more in the abstract of existence as a whole.
More specific, yeah?
Yeah, because existence as a whole is, has, if you're a human being at least, always has some beautiful qualities by definition.
Mm.
So you can't just say it's a defilement, because they're beautiful qualities
always.
So it's not a true description to say existence is a defilement.
Yeah, I think it would be more, I mean, literally, I mean, you know, as a literal doctrinal definition, you'd say like a desire for rebirth is actually like a. It's good to make these things concrete first, to give it a really concrete, thin doctrinal definition first. So in that sense, it would be like desire for rebirth, and then you can from there you can then sort of reflect and consider, okay, what might it mean, or how we might consider it, and so on and so forth, and then that gives you a basis for doing that. But yeah, I think that's. And those ideas, like you're talking about, like those. See, just like those shapes that you create in your mind, the forms that you create in your mind, which give you a sense of identity. Yeah, the patterns you create in your mind. Those are the things which, because they have a certain tenacity, because they have a certain stickiness. They remain over long periods of time. You know, we can look back into our childhood and see that we had similar kinds of ideas and so on. And it's because of that stickiness to them. That's why they channel a huge amount of karmic energy, yeah, and give shape to that karmic energy over a long period of time. And then this is what's actually creating rebirth and existence. That's why the human realm is so powerful for creating existence, because we have that capacity.
Remember that Dhamharas, what is it? Kinasava Jyoti Mantan,
Yeah. So it's interesting for this subject. Yeah. Okay. And what are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to? They are the things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of sensual desire is abandoned, the unarisen taint of existence does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of existence is abandoned. The unarisen taint of ignorance does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of ignorance is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to. By attending to things unfit for attention, and by not attending to things fit for attention, both unarisen taints arise in him, and arisen taints increase. Now, so this is like the general principle, but what are those things that one should not be paying attention to? And this is how he attends unwisely. And one of my favorite passages in the suttas. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? What shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where is this being come from, and where will it go? When he attends unwisely in this way, one of six views arises in him. The view self exists for me arises in him as true and established. Or the view no self exists for me arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with self arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive not self with self arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with not self arises in him as true and established. Or else he has some such view as this. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity itself. This speculative view, bhikkhus, is called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person is not freed from birth, aging, death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He is not freed from suffering, I say. So here's obviously a fairly powerful passage on the investigation into not-self. And of course all of these questions, we come back to the questions like, was I in the past, was I not, and what was I, and how was I, and having been what did I become, and so on. And then Bhavisami. And so these are all variations on the kind of one of the classic phrases of Indian philosophy, Ahamasmi. This is like the kind of the primal phrase in Indian or Vedic or Brahmanical philosophy, Ahamasmi. This is like the word which was uttered in various, I can't remember the exact mythic context, but I think it was like the first word that was uttered by Prajapati at the dawn of the world or something like this, Ahamasmi, I am. Yeah? Ahamasmi, I am. And so here he's like analyzing these things, is like saying these things are not like a profound insight into the nature of being or anything like that, but it's actually just resulting from this restless inquiry into this kind of endless seeking for that which can't be found. It's kind of what we use the word metaphysical to describe this kind of inquiry. And when we use this word metaphysical, or when I use it in Buddhism, probably in lack of a better word, I'm following David Kalapahana in his usage, and David Kalapahana follows Wittgenstein. But in this sense, metaphysical means something which is inherently unknowable, okay? Something which is by its very nature or by its very definition is unknowable. And so a lot of our search, our religious or spiritual quest, especially in ancient India, was this metaphysical search for this self, and this self which was in the ultimate sense is inherently unknowable. It's not merely that it's unknown. It's not merely that we happen to not have realized it, but we might one day, but that by its very definition it's something which we can't actually see or we can't know. And so when we are investigating into this thing, and of course that in that investigation, in that inquiry, the very existence of the self, which is something unknowable, is not the object of inquiry. Okay, that is always assumed, that's underlying it. And so it's the same, exactly the same process as happened with Descartes, that he was the great French philosopher, that he was able to systematically doubt everything in the world, the existence of everything, including the existence of the entire world, but he couldn't doubt his own existence. I think, therefore I am. And so he was never able to doubt that I think, therefore I am. And this was the one thing he was never able to doubt. And we see this same kind of process here. And of all the philosophies in the world, it's probably only the Buddha who was really able to go beyond that. So, and the different kinds of view. Now again, these kinds of views have to be careful to interpret these in their Indic context. Ati me atta, myself exists, or the self exists for me. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated it as very very literally, me for me, although that idiom in Pali usually just means my, okay, so myself exists. But the implication there, the implication is not simply that the self exists, but that the self exists forever, okay? It's not explicitly formulated in that way, but that's the underlying implication which is drawn out time and time again throughout Indic philosophy, that somehow existence has something intrinsic to it, inherently exists, and therefore it must exist for itself. If something is, then it must be, it is in a profound way, not just in a temporal way that we say this book exists or something like that, but it actually is in and of itself. This is a tendency which is endemic right throughout Indic philosophy. And so when we see nati me atta, myself does not exist, again this has a slightly different implication than we would read it in English. And this is brought out in a particular sutta, in the Vajragupta Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, where he says, the Buddha explains this, nati atta means that this self that I have will be destroyed. Okay, so nati atta, that myself does not exist, does not mean that simply I have no self. It means that the self will be destroyed, right? And so this is an implication in the term which is quite different from the English implication. Okay, so nati me atta, the self will be destroyed, and the almost like it's betrayed by the me in there, of me, the self of me will be destroyed. So there's like a still an implication of self in there, even though he's saying that there is no self. But actually what it means is perhaps, you know, this self which exists, this physical self which exists in this life, this will be destroyed at the end of my life. And then these different kinds of seeing. Atanava atanan sanjanamiti. one sees self with self, perceives, but of course here being perceives self with self, sanjanami. And of course we've already learnt in the Mulapariyaya Sutta last week what exactly the implications of this are, that one has sanya, one has a perception of the self, right? But that doesn't mean, of course, what you're seeing is a self. That means that your mind is creating in it, through this process of conceptual creation, this idea of a self. And so whether you see self with not self, or not self with self, or not self with not self, and all of these kinds of different perceptions, these are ways of seeing, ways of perception. And then that gives rise to a view. Again, we talked about last week with the Mulapariyaya Sutta, this process where you move from a perception of something which is pre-conceptual or proto-conceptual. It's like the bubbling up of an idea. The perception is like the bubbling. It's just seeing something through a framework which will give rise to that kind of idea. And then the ditthi, the view, is the actual explicit articulation of that, the explicit formulation of that in your mind, that I see self with not self, and so on. So you know, it's these very interesting connections between these first two suttas. Also would draw your attention to these words Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated as true and established, sacchato tetato, this being a somewhat controversial phrase in Buddhist philosophy. Now in the first dialogue in the Katavattu, the collection of controversies over Buddhist doctrines we find in the Abhidhamma, then the first controversy there is the question of the existence of the pugala, of the person. And of course the Pugalavada school of Buddhism was asserting that there was a pugala, and it uses the phrase sacchato tetato, okay, is true and established. And notice that it's exactly the same phrase that's used here in talking about the self, but the Pugalavadins insisting that the self is sacchato tetato, is true and established. The pugala is true and established. Now, whether this is a destruction of the idea of not self, of course, is the position of most of the schools of Buddhism. But interestingly enough, that this phrase sacchato tetato is interpreted by the commentary as meaning in the ultimate sense, and so paramattato. So this difference is pointed out by Kalapahana in quite a brilliant essay on this treatise in the Katavattu. And we see this difference that for the Katavattu, in its discussion, its refutation of the pugala was based entirely on like trapping his opponent into illogical or contradictory statements. Okay, so it was a logical, pointing out logical flaws in the person, inconsistencies in the person's position. Now the commentary then says that the pugala doesn't really truly really exist, but the five khandhas really truly really exist. Okay, and this is an entirely different kind of argument, which is surreptitiously introduced into this by the commentary. So that philosophically the important thing is that we've now shifted the argument from an argument about logic and consistency to an argument about ontology, what really exists in the world. And the commentarial position being that the self does not really truly really exist in the world, but the five khandhas really truly really exist in the world. Okay? Now notice that when we look at the Sabhasava Sutta, that kind of argument is not being made. Okay? So the person who's having that view of a self has the view that the self is true and established and so on. But the Buddha does not contradict that by saying, no, it's not the self which is truly, really existing in the world. It's the five khandhas which are truly, really existing in the world. So it's important to notice this distinction. That kind of argument is not made in the suttas, not made by the Buddha, but is introduced in the commentarial period. Okay?
I don't really understand that logic. If they say truly, really exist, then what happens when say, for instance, our river runs, when part of the five khandhas don't exist in those realms,
mm-hmm.
and then also with nirvana, then there are no five khandhas, the ending of five khandhas.
But about nirvana, then truly, really exists.
Oh, I see. But then the khandhas can't really truly, really exist if nirvana truly, really exists.
Yeah.
Because that, then, according to that system, five khandhas change into nirvana.
Well, that's problematic anyway, but the important thing is just to notice the different ways of arguing, and that these different ways of arguing are introduced kind of surreptitiously without you really noticing. which is the important thing. Now, the other next view that it has here, this self of mind that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions, this is very similar to another kind of view which we'll meet later in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta. And this being a much more developed and articulated view of a self. This self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. Okay, so this, of course, being a fully fledged view of the self or the soul. And I was talking with Venerable Tapasi earlier and pointing out that these phrases in the Pali follow a principle which is known as the waxing syllable principle, and this is an outstanding stylistic feature of Pali literature, which is that when you have a list, it occurs in many different forms, but in this particular form you have a list of things, a list of what is effectively synonyms, and that the organizing principle for this list of synonyms is the number of syllables in each word. So for example, here you have Nicho Dhuvo Sasato Aviparinama Dhammo. So two syllables, three syllables, and then how many? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine syllables. So two, two, three, and nine. Then later on, this is permanent, stable, eternal, and not subject to change. And then we have the wilderness of views, contortion of views, and so on. In the Pali, Ditti Gatang, Ditti Gahanang, Ditti Kantarang, Ditti Visukang, Ditti Vipanditang, Ditti Sanyojanang. So four syllables, five syllables, Kantarang, five syllables, and then Vipanditang, six syllables, and then again six syllables. So four, five, 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 six, and six. So just interesting to note this. This is important. This has significance in two ways. One way is that sometimes when we're looking at the suttas, we wonder, why is it that this particular, you know, these particular choices of words were used in this particular way? And people, we try, and I encounter this quite often when people are reading the suttas, especially in translation, that they will read quite a lot from particular choices of English renderings to try to derive why that particular word is used there. And of course, this is very dubious, because there are principles at work which are not at all reflected in the English translation. And here it's a stylistic thing which has not to do with the meanings of the words. It has to do with the euphony of reciting it. And that when you recite it like that, it has this kind of dung-ka-da-da-da kind of effect, where it's actually like a rhythmic characteristic of the prose rather than being actually the literal meaning of the words. So that's one thing to notice that. And also to notice that sometimes, and with due caution and consideration for other factors, we can use that principle to determine whether a particular list is authentic or whether it's been corrupted or not. Due to various kinds of textual corruption, if they don't follow that principle, we might speculate that the reason for not following that principle is that the text has been corrupted for some reason. And that's the definitive study on that was done by Mark Allen from Sydney Uni. So we have the book downstairs if anybody's interested in the waxing syllables principle. Nevertheless, it is quite probably the case that you can become an arahant without knowing anything about the waxing syllables principle. And so let us go on with the rest of the sutta. Because a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their dhamma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their dhamma, understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, and he attends to those things fit for attention. What are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to? They are things such that... And of course, here we're going to one of these repetition passages and repeating the opposite of what we've just read before. So I won't go into those things. But then the interesting part is the last paragraph. He attends wisely. This is suffering. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This, of course, being the Four Noble Truths. And it being slightly unusual that uses the formula that he attends wisely in this context. Normally would say he knows and sees in accordance with truth or something like that. When he attends wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him. Personality view, or which Bhikkhu Bodhi later renders identity view, which is much better, Sakkaya Ditthi, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. And again, Bhikkhu Bodhi's changed his rendering here, adherence to rules and observances. And this is another one, Paramasa, that I had some difference of opinion with Bhikkhu Bodhi when discussing the Samyutta, because Paramasa literally means holding on to or something, but there's several contexts where it seems to mean like it has an almost inbuilt sense of wrongness to it, like a misapprehension. And I notice Bhikkhu Bodhi here has translated it as, in the later list, as, what has he got? Wrong grasp, okay? Wrong grasp of rules and observances, or misapprehension of rules and observances, rather than adherence. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So, abandoning of those three fetters, of course, being signifying that one has attained stream entry. So here he's talking about the stream entry, seeing the Four Noble Truths, attaining the stream entry, abandoning the three fetters, and the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. Now this is a very, very important little doctrinal snippet, right? Because this is giving you a lot of keys for understanding the way that these kinds of ideas are used and treated in the suttas. When the suttas say, you know and see things as they really are, okay, Yathabhuta Jnana Dasana, usually it refers to stream entry. When the suttas say that you understand the Four Noble Truths, usually it will be referring to stream entry. I'm not saying it always does, but it usually will refer to stream entry. And when it talks about someone having that kind of vision of seeing things properly, then this is usually referring to stream entry. And so this again is giving us a key for understanding quite a few passages in the suttas. Okay? Now this seeing, dasana, had a lot, gained a lot of importance in the Buddhist systems, the systems of systematizing the path in various schools. And dasana, the seeing, is always associated with that time of stream entry. Okay? I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But anyway, it's important to notice, because that's that moment of seeing. So it's almost as if that the rest of them are following on after stream entry. One wonders about what the significance of that is. Perhaps we don't have to restrain ourselves until we've become stream enters already. That'd be handy, wouldn't it? Usually it's the other way around, isn't it? Yeah, usually the restraint...
But here he usually tells the bad stuff, then the good stuff, so then now he's telling the bad stuff, then the good stuff, and then the good stuff, 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 then the good stuff,
Okay. What taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by restraining? Here, bhikkhus, reflecting wisely, patisankha yoniso, abides with the eye faculty restrained, while taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who abides with the eye faculty unrestrained. There are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who abides with the eye faculty restrained. Reflecting wisely, he abides with ear faculty restrained, with the nose faculty restrained, tongue faculty restrained, body faculty restrained, mind faculty restrained. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who abides with the faculties unrestrained, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who abides with the faculties restrained. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by restraining, or sangvara. Okay, so this is one of the standard passages about sense restraint that we find in the suttas, and obviously referring to one of the very basic, very important practices in the training, that one has to continue to have the mindfulness, have awareness of what's going on through your senses, that that you know what is going to give rise to, as it says, taints, fixation, and fever through the senses. Now notice that this has some connection with this jhana idea that we were talking before about the asravas or the karma as like inflowing into the mind through the senses. But of course the Buddhist idea not being that one should simply not see or not hear or not smell or not taste or not touch. It's not being about like removal of the senses, and that being a point which is made quite strongly in the last sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, and I'll just read the passage here. And the Buddha talking with the Brahman Uttara, who's a student of the Brahman Parasarya. Does the Brahman Parasarya teach his disciples the development of the faculties, Indriya Bhavana? He does, Master Gotama, but, Uttara, how does he teach his disciples the development of the faculties? Here, Master Gotama, one does not see forms with the eye. One does not hear sounds with the ear. That is how the Brahman Parasarya teaches his disciples the development of the faculties. And the Buddha replied, if that was so, Uttara, then a blind man and a deaf man will have developed faculties according to what the Brahman Parasarya says. For a blind man does not see forms with the eye, and a deaf man does not hear sounds with the ear. When this was said, the Brahman student Uttara sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. So this is interesting little refutation there. There's a very controversial passage in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta just before the end of the Buddha's life. Ananda says, Buddha, what should we do about women? Buddha says, don't see them. Do not see them, Ananda. He says, but Buddha, what if we have to see them sometimes? He says, don't talk to them. And he says, but what if we have to talk to them? He says, just be mindful, Ananda. And so Maurice Walsh, in his translation of that, pointed out that passage seems to be interpolated, since it doesn't have any relation to the context either preceding or following it. And in fact, when we compare with the Sanskrit version of that particular sutta, we do indeed find that it's completely absent. And moreover, when we compare it with such passages as the Indriya Bhavana Sutra and so on, find that it's exactly what the Buddha is ridiculing as being sense restraint, is not seeing things, but being careful and being mindful of what we do see, is the actual Buddhist teaching on sense restraint, not simply not seeing. And there are many cases where the Buddha in fact invites and requests Ananda to go and teach the lay women or the bhikkhunis or whoever it is. And so this is certainly not the case that the Buddha expected Ananda never to see or to speak with women. And in fact, just before that passage in the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, in fact, the Buddha is praising Ananda, because whenever he goes to see the Upasa, the laywomen or the bhikkhunis, then they're always very glad to see him, and they always listen to what he has to say, and they always want him to stay longer. And the Buddha is praising this as one of the wonderful and marvelous qualities of Ananda. And then a few lines later, he's supposed to be saying, don't see them at all. So these are the kinds of little contradictions which one may observe occasionally within the suttas.
What's your understanding when he talks about restraining in terms of the faculties? Does that mean you come in with the understanding when you see something beautiful, like say I'm looking at the flowers, beautiful. You say, oh, it's beautiful, I need to be aware of longing? I mean, is it when he talks about seeing, or is it just mindful, you see it, and if desire arises, you note desire without attaching to desire?
Yeah, both, I would think. Depending on how strong the thing you're seeing is, how strong your desire may be, you know, if you're in a fairly neutral kind of space where the senses are fairly cool, you know, then you can just kind of watch them. If you're somewhere where, you know, where it's more aggressive and more stimulating, then you need to be more sort of consciously aware. So this is where that kind of wisdom faculty works in, you know. Yeah. Yeah, but that's also like, you know, a specific example with flowers is quite a nice one, because, you know, as Buddhists we use flowers on the shrine and we like to sort of do that to make it beautiful, and Buddhism has a very kind of beautiful aesthetic, you know. There is a love and appreciation of beauty within Buddhism, but there's also that, you know, that the decay of the flowers is also the kind of one of the classic images for impermanence, and that's, you know, we offer the flowers, but then we understand that within a day or two that they'll be faded and so on, unless of course they're plastic flowers. Right? In which case they're not even beautiful when they're first put there, so it's slightly different. But we notice, oh, okay, and they're very beautiful in that they will fade, you know, so that's that kind of slight, it gives you a slight distance around it. Yeah.
Seeing in that understanding,
yeah,
of impermanence. Yeah. So I have one more question then in relationship to the three personality types,
mm-hmm,
in the commentaries,
mm-hmm,
and for aversive types needing to surround themselves with beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So
when they come to the monastery, the monks usually try to convince the abbot that they're kind of aversive types, so they need to get the best kuti and best food.
So that's not in contradiction to what they're saying.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Here's a skillful means.
Exactly. Here's a skillful means to work with those things. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's not just desire which gives rise to the senses, also aversion gets rise to the senses. So if you're surrounded by things that are going to give you rise to aversion, then you need to restrain yourself with regard to those things. Yeah.
Well, there are these two words, fixation and fever, that he uses just here.
Yeah.
And they're covering those two, the fever of desire and uh-huh, attraction.
Yeah.
Fixation of this aversion.
Yeah, yeah. So, the power of aversion.
Fixation is not a word so much used with things, is it?
No, vexes. No. I was trying to see what the Pali for that is. Vighata parilaha. Yeah. Okay. Now, what taints because should be abandoned by using? And Patisevana. Here, Bhikkhu reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. Reflecting wisely, uses alms food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort and for assisting the holy life. Considering thus, I shall terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless, and shall live in comfort. So this is the slightly unusual idiom here, talking about that ending old feelings without arousing new feelings, and that can be understood in like an immediate sense, that when you have a feeling of hunger, that you eat, so that you will end those feelings of hunger without giving rise to new feelings of being stuffed and overfull and sick from eating, but also can be understood in a more profound sense, in the sense that by using food without attachment to it, then those feelings which you experience in this very life, which are the old feelings which you've inherited from your past karma, then those will come to an end at the end of this life, and without giving rise to new feelings in the next life because of your attachment. Reflecting wisely, he uses the resting place only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate and for enjoying retreat. Reflecting wisely, he uses the medicinal requisites only for protection from arisen afflicting feelings and for the benefit of good health. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who uses them thus. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by using. So this is, of course, the basic reflection on the use of the requisites, which is enjoined on or encouraged for summoners to make each time that we use the requisites, and are very commonly recited before taking the meal. And we'll recite the reflection on the alms food, and a very good thing to do. They certainly should know these, as a summoner should know these phrases by heart. You know, it is something that we need to keep an awareness of, and we need to be vigilant with, because as bhikkhus, as bhikkhunis, as people practicing the path, that we do get lots of requisites these days. We're living in a very wealthy society. We see people walking around. When I was in Bodh Gaya, we see monks with silk robes, And one might ask whether this is an appropriate thing for monks to be wearing silken robes. We do get offered lots of delicious alms food, and we can become indulging in these things. And I saw this again when I was in Bodh Gaya, that the monks were at this particular place where I was at meal one time. I felt extremely uncomfortable because sitting around with the monks, and the monks were all, speaking in Thai, but they were all, get this, get that, bring that over here, offer this to them, get that, some of this, offer this to this, and this is how they were just talking to the lay people. Come on, bring this over here, come on, we need this now, come on, bring it over, offer this to someone. Yeah, okay, you've offered it now, you've got your merit, come on, go on, time to eat your meal. And this is how they were talking to the lay people. And I was extremely uncomfortable to be sharing the table with these venerable sirs, and I didn't go back there to eat again. So please remember that the food that's offered is just offered out of the kindness of people's hearts. It's not for us to be telling them that this is delicious, this is not delicious, and we want this, we don't want that, and so on and so forth. But just to accept and to take what we need for eating. The same with the robe. I know many of the monks here wearing robes that are just made out of bits and scraps and of patches and so on. So this is highly praiseworthy practice. And also the dwelling place, and this is something that it's interesting that there was an article about this in Gregory Chopin talked about the Venerable Udayan, that he had this in the vinaya, he had this kind of this kuti that was sort of very nice, and he'd done it up really nicely and had these kind of gardens and different sections, and sort of the lay people would come and he'd sort of show them through and be showing off his different kinds aspects of his dwelling place. And while he was showing this couple around, he actually groped the wife of the householder who was coming around, and this was considered to be slightly inappropriate behavior for a monk. But and Gregory Chopin made the slightly cynical remark that even in this day and age, that many forest monks and forest monasteries, one also sees dwellings which are equally as luxurious as those dwellings described by the Venerable Udayan, perhaps even more so. And large marble kutis being made for abbots of monasteries and various things like that is a noteworthy feature of the forest tradition, one which I think could be rapidly improved by employing a D4 bulldozer. Okay, what taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by enduring? Here, bhikkhu. A bhikkhu reflecting wisely bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing and menacing to life. While taints, vexation and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no taints, vexation or fever that arise in one who endures them. These are called the taints to be abandoned by enduring adhivasana. So this one, this is a bit of a kind of a macho one. This is where you get into that kind of tough forest tradition kind of stuff, you know, just endure. And of course, if you listen to the teachings of the forest monks, then you'll read many, many stories about the different kinds of endurance that they had to practice. I won't sort of go into too many of the anecdotes. I'm sure you've heard many of them before. But I would just notice that the interesting thing is the ill-spoken, unwelcome words one. And this again, this particular section and that particular phrase especially also does remind me a little bit of the Jaina context. And the Jaina monks were wandering around naked and they never had a bath. Okay, now the combination of these two things is somewhat challenging in certain contexts, like, for example, meeting another human being in any or in an airport, yes, arriving at Australian immigration, for example, would tend to arouse a little bit of distress or whatever. And so there's a lot of stuff if you read the Jaina sutras, there's a lot of stuff about, you know, then coming into the villages and then being abused and yelled at and people throwing stones and sticks at them and so on, that similar to what we find here. Much more so. We find that occasionally in the Buddhist scriptures, but not nearly so much. And so I think that the poor old Jains had to put up with quite a lot more of this kind of thing. But again, we see that kind of slight implication of a connection with the Jaina context. taints should be abandoned by avoiding parivajana. What taints should be abandoned by avoiding? Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu reflecting wisely avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable resorts, like Club Med or something like that. Resort means like a place where you go for alms. Okay, so there's certain places which are regarded as unsuitable for going for alms, like going to a pub or a brothel or something like this. It'll probably be regarded as unsuitable. Sorry?
I think it's the same at widows.
Widows, going to see women, going to single women and widows for a resort. Associating with bad friends, since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no taints, vexation, and fever in the one who avoids them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. Oh, sorry, I should just mention something I forgot to mention, talking about the reflection on the requisites. Venerable Analia has the following little note here. All of the versions, that means the two Pali, all the Pali versions and all the Chinese versions, the proper use of robes means to use them just to cover the body and to protect the body from the impact of weather and insects. Now, the Majjhima Agama version, however, adds that robes should not be used for the purpose of adornment. But the two Pali versions speak of avoiding adornment in relation to the proper use of alms food. This is a little curious, since it seems difficult to conceive of a way how alms food can be used for the purpose of ornament or adornment, whereas in the case of robes, such misuse can more easily be thought of. A discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya and its parallel in the Samyukta Agama record such a case of when the monk Nanda incurred the Buddha's reproach for wearing ironed robes. So, hence, in this case, it would seem that the Chinese version has preserved the more fitting presentation. So, Venerable Analio suggesting that the word vibhusana, or adornment, is perhaps more fitting to be applied to robes than applied to food. Not 100% convinced there. Perhaps maybe more kind of an idiomatic, and they often in Indic society, you use food to get plump.
That's what I was going to mention.
That
one doesn't apply these days. People want to be skinny.
So it's like to kind of plumpen yourself up is considered to be beautiful. But perhaps maybe something to that. Removing. Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. He abandons it, removes it, does away with it, and annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will an arisen thought of cruelty. These, of course, being the three kinds of michā saṅkappa in the Noble Eightfold Path. Wrong intention or wrong thought. He does not tolerate arisen evil, unwholesome dhammas. He abandons them, removes them, does away with them, and annihilates them. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not remove these thoughts, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who removes them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by removing. Okay? So, this again being a very standard passage, which we find very frequently talking about the control or the watching of one's thoughts. And this being a counter context to this, the idea that we have this sort of thing of non-judgmental awareness or choiceless awareness, which many people talk of these days, that you should just watch whatever happens without actually judging it. And you can indeed find certain passages in the suttas where the Buddha is talking about this, but you can also find many passages when the Buddha is talking about being very judgmental in your thoughts. And if you've got these wrong thoughts in there, you do not tolerate them. You abandon them, remove them, do away them and annihilate them. There's very strong language, anabhavam gameti, very aptly translated as annihilate. It's a very strong phrase. And so there is a role in practice for just watching things with a kind of non-judgmental awareness, and then there's a role for getting rid of those bad things and developing the good things. And especially the non-judgmental awareness is more useful especially at advanced stages of practice, when you can really have a sense of equanimity towards them and a sense of space around things, then the actual way of getting rid of them is often simply to observe them, and then you watch their own impermanence. But until you have a bit of space in your mind, it's not easy to do that.
I think how I've understood it or phrased it is that the mindfulness is non-judgmental, judgmental in the sense of non-aversive. You know, mm-hmm. it's not fed by the negative tendency towards getting rid of something mm-hmm. that's unpleasant. So it's the mindfulness is based on discernment, and mm-hmm. then you use discernment when
sure.
you see that just being mindful isn't enough. You have to use right effort
yep.
to abandon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Different functions of the mind, exactly. And sometimes observing yes. is enough,
yes.
and sometimes it's not.
Right.
You know, just like you, I mean, you can see that even in everyday cases, yeah, that sometimes these things, observing, just watching is enough. I read a very interesting article in the Bangkok Post when I was on the way back from India, and it was an article about rape, and it said that nine out of ten cases, if the woman looks the would-be rapist in the eye, then he'll stop. 9 out of 10 cases, yeah, which is why they always try to sneak up from behind. And they especially attack women who are listening to using a cell phone or listening to headphones or something like that, because then they won't turn around and look. But if you actually look at them, and especially if you speak, what are you doing? Who are you? Then 9 out of 10 times they'll stop. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So, but there's still 1 out of 10 times when they won't stop. If you need to give them. So, okay. Now. I asked before this question about the knowing and seeing. We had this little discussion, but notice that in each of these cases, it actually uses this phrase, reflecting wisely. So that suggestion which we had earlier, that each one of these is accompanied by wisdom, is accompanied by knowing and seeing, is also explicitly stated. It's not just an inference, but it's quite clearly stated there that in doing these things, you're not doing them just automatically, but you are actually doing it with a sense of wisdom, a sense of reflection about it. The final one. What taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by developing? Here, bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, develops the mindfulness awakening factor. So I use awakening factor rather than enlightenment factor, Bhikkhu Bodhi has here. And I'll read the note here, the book called Bojanga, and Bodhi and Anga, and Analeo's little note here. By rendering Bojanga as awakening factor instead of the more usual enlightenment factor, I follow the suggestions made by Migo and Norman on how best to translate the Pali term Bodhi, the root Bud, so both of them point out means to wake up or awaken, and does not bear any relation to light. To this it could be added that the early Buddhist concept of Bodhi refers to experiencing Nibbana, an experience which the Pali discourses compare rather to the extinction of a light. Even the expression Aloka Uddapadi, used by the Buddha in relation to his awakening, does not seem to refer to the arising of light, but rather to the arising of clarity. In order to present mistaking meditative experiences of an inner light for Bodhi, it would seem preferable to use the translation awakening, which better corresponds to Bodhi on both philological and practical grounds. So I think those suggestions by Nale are very sensible, and it is certainly a very cogent kind of warning that enlightenment experience, Nirvana, is not the appearance of an inner light, and certainly this is not something we should read into the term enlightenment. There's no implication of that, the appearance of inner lights and so on being rather samadhi experiences rather than enlightenment experiences. And actually the use of the word enlightenment is not really justified by the Pali, and in fact was adopted by the early Indologist, Rhys Davies and so on, in an explicit reference to what the historical phenomena in the West, which is known as the Enlightenment. And when they were using the term, they were quite deliberately creating the connection between the kinds of changes and insights and innovations that the Buddha had and those kinds of innovations which were brought about in Europe during the period of the Enlightenment by the great Enlightenment philosophers. This is why they use that term. So develops the mindfulness awakening factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. He develops the investigation of dhammas awakening factor, the investigation, the energy awakening factor, the rapture awakening factor, the tranquility awakening factor, the concentration awakening factor, and the equanimity awakening factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and vexation, and ripens in relinquishment. While taints, vexation and fever might arise in one who does not develop these awakening factors, there are no taints, vexation or fever in one who develops them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by developing. So this, of course, being a very standard passage on the development of the seven awakening factors, bhojangas. I won't go into detail talking about these now. There'll be other chances for that. But just to notice that these seven factors are one of the groups in the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. This particular passage appearing frequently, especially in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Bodhanga Sanyutta. And here, the idea here between of development, what development means, the literal meaning of development, bhavana, is a causative form from the root bhava. Bhava meaning to exist, bhavana to cause to exist or to make exist, okay? Or to make more of something. So what bhavana literally means is to make more of something. So something is already there, now we're making more of it. This is what bhavana is. So when those things have already been arisen, then to bhavana them, to make more of them, is really what's talked about here. So we mentioned at the beginning of it, that one is a stream enterer, okay? So the dasana is the vision, the seeing is the stream enterer. And so now this particular passage in this context is applying to those who are beyond stream entry, who are taking those things which have already been awakened by the stream enterer and are now making more of them, developing them fully to enlightenment. And these two phrases, dasana and bhavana, became absolutely standard, one of the very, very standard classification contexts that you read often if you're reading, especially Tibetan, descriptions of the path, what they call the Hinayana path or the early Buddhism path. They will divide it up into five sections. I don't know if I can remember them. So the fourth and fifth are the Darshana Marga and Bhavana Marga. First three, I can't remember the names of them now. Usma, I think one of them is. The third and fourth are the Darshana Marga and Bhavana Marga. The fifth one is the Aseka Marga in Pali, the path of the non-trainer or one beyond training. So this group of five is a way of dividing and explaining and classifying the path, which is found in the Sarvastivadin scriptures, which is not found explicitly in the same way in the Pali or the commentarial system. But it's worth having a little bit of familiarity with it, because you will meet it if you read any Tibetan texts or texts from a Tibetan background describing early Buddhism. And this is taken from books like the Abhidharma Kosha and so on. The first one, which I can't remember the name of, I have to look it up, is basically Sila and Samadhi. It goes all the way up from the beginning of the path and developing up to the attainment of jhana. The second one is essentially what we would call vipassana, okay? So it's equivalent to what the Pali commentaries would talk about when developing the vipassana jnanas. And the third one is the dasana, is the seeing, the actual seeing of the Four Noble Truths at the time of stream entry. The fourth one, bhavana, refers to those who are the sekhas, those who are in training, who've already seen the Four Noble Truths and are developing them further for full enlightenment. And then the aseka, the non-trained or one beyond training, is the of course the arahant, Aseka Marga. So these five way of describing the path in terms of five sections. The first one is Sila Samadhi, the second one is the wisdom or vipassana aspect, then the seeing of the Four Noble Truths, the trainee, and the one beyond training, the adept, the arahant. So it's interesting to have a bit of familiarity with that, because you will encounter that if you look at the Tibetan texts. Bhikkhus, when for a bhikkhu the taints that should be abandoned by seeing have been abandoned by seeing, when the taints that have been abandoned by restraining have been abandoned by restraining, when the taints that should be abandoned by using have been abandoned by using, when the taints that should be abandoned by enduring have been abandoned by enduring, when the taints it should be abandoned by avoiding have been abandoned by avoiding, when the taints it should be abandoned by removing have been abandoned by removing, when the taints it should be abandoned by developing have been abandoned by developing, then he is called a bhikkhu who dwells restrained with the restraint of all the taints. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit he has made an end of suffering. And of course this is referring to the arahant. And this is what the Blessed One said. Bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So this is the Sabbasava Sutta. And any more final questions or comments or
Yes, really, but there were no tents that were abandoned by seeing. There were fetters that were abandoned by seeing.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in this later version that the asava of views was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
That
oh, yeah, yeah, you're
could
right.
be covered.
Oh, yeah.
The taint.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Actually, in the text, it doesn't, it says something about fetters.
Yeah, yeah.
To be abandoned. Oh, no, it does. It says the taints that should be abandoned by seeing, but actually.
It's not in the actual list. You're right there. I made a mistake when I was explaining that before. It's mistakenly said it was the taint of ignorance was the one that was added, but of course it's not. It's the taint of use that was the one that was added later. Yeah, that's a very good point, and quite possibly, you know, it was under the influence of this sutta, because this sutta has obviously been very influential, you know, number 2 in the Majjhima, that in order to actually collate the list that was actually added there.
But you also said, or Ananda said, that this first one, the taints to be abandoned by seeing, was not included in that early Taisho rendering.
No, in the Anguttara Nikaya version. All the Chinese have it, not the Anguttara version.
And it would make more sense, actually. If it's talking about taint, the asavas,
yeah.
Then it would make more sense for that whole section not to be there.
Yeah, it could be. I think, it's not sure. That particular sutra in the Anguttara, now, when it starts out, it says, endowed with 6 factors, a bhikkhu is worthy of offerings, worthy of gifts, worthy of reverence, worthy of making anjali, and is an unexcelled field of merit for the world, obviously meaning like an arya, yeah? Endowed with what, 6, and one who has abandoned the kind of taints abandoned by those 3. So you would think that someone who's had the dasana, had the vision, should be included in there, shouldn't they? Because there'd be a stream entra, yeah. Yeah, so a bit of ambiguity, but also remember that you know, these words are used rather more loosely, and as time goes on, tend to get more systematized. You know, so I mean, one could, for example, one could understand the defilement of ignorance. As far as ignorance is also including views under ignorance.
Well, they're very close.
Yeah. I mean, views being a kind of a more gross or form of ignorance.
You said that the thing that are very definite are the ones that the seeker should be developing.
Yeah.
Doesn't leave much for us to develop to get the stream entry, does it?
Well, I suspect it probably applies just as much to us as it does to the seeker, but yeah. Okay. So, enough for today.
Aham samma sambuddho bhagava buddham bhagavantam abhivade svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammam namasami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namah.